Hello, I'm Robert Bounds, and this is the Monocle Culture Show. This week, we're taking a trip to the National Gallery, where two exhibitions by two artists are running concurrently, Thomas Cole's Eden to Empire and Ed Richet's Course of Empire. As the titles might hint, there's a link between these two artists' work, and to examine that with me in the studio today, I'll be joined by Ossian Ward, Head of Content at the Listen Gallery, and Eddie Frankel, Visual Art Editor for Time Out London and the founding editor of Oof, a football and art magazine. The 19th century painter Thomas Cole is one of a handful of artists known for their romantic landscapes of the United States. He was a founder of the Hudson River School, an art movement dedicated to this style of depiction on the East Coast. His paintings offer dramatic but dreamy vistas, a sort of fairy tale image of the American wilderness. Ed Richet is an artist associated with pop art. Working across a number of disciplines, he's known for his paintings and photography concerned with landscape, especially California, as well as his word paintings and interests in typography. Well, that's those guys, Eddie and Ossian. Welcome to the programme.
Hey.
Hi.
Nice to have you both here to talk through an exhibition at the National Gallery here in London, which is fairly decent timing. We're in a strange place, or America seems to be in a strange place. The rest of the world's idea of the United States is perhaps a strange, stretched, and maybe historical one, who knows? I don't know which end of the telescope we're looking. Ossian, I'll start with you. Thomas Cole is the sort of old oils section of this show. Maybe you can give our listeners a little bit of a potted idea of Thomas Cole, who he is and what he looks like.
Yeah, he was born in Bolton, up north, and then they...
You're going to do an accent, but didn't
I was going
few.
To. Yeah, I just skipped that. I thought, oh, let's edit that out. Okay, gone. The northern accent is done. So, he moved from Bolton to America, to Philadelphia, and then to various other parts. But along the way, learnt from kind of Constable and Turner, you know, learnt the British way, let's say.
Yeah.
And then arrived in America in this totally wild, different landscape, you know, the broad skies. And so all of those things come to bear. What's relevant today is that he was painting the demise of the American landscape, you know, even at the time we think of it as progress, you know, in the Hudson River School.
Was this like a reaction against revolution and industry and stuff, like people were painting the mills of Manchester and things?
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, in the mills where he famously would have seen the Luddites burning the mills down in, I can't remember the town, not Leeds, but, you know, up north, do the accent. And so, you know, he would have seen the reaction firsthand in Britain and then moved to America and seen a different kind of progress, probably a bigger scale, things coming, you know, big railroads, things happening that were sort of threatening this landscape. And he used the wildness of the landscape to kind of juxtapose what would be the coming of industry, the coming of, you know, the 19th, 20th century, and what he kind of saw as something to destroy all of this. I mean, the Course of Empire, if we want to talk about that, were five paintings that he did for a rich patron, and the guy wanted them, like, around his fireplace. So he'd made this scheme for these five paintings. And they're pretty incredible because they go from the savage state, which is basically the landscape in its original form, you know, a kind of hunter chasing a deer and the rolling hills and everything looking bucolic and wonderful, as you said. And then you go to the next painting, which is the Arcadian or pastoral state, and you get the same vista, more or less. You can see this hill that's kind of throughout these five paintings. And now we have, you know, people tilling the fields and a kind of Stonehenge in the background and more life coming there. And a little, you know, glimpse at the bottom of a soldier. And you're like, OK, something's coming.
Yeah.
The next one is insane because it's called The Consummation. And it's basically like Rome, you know, Babylon, everything coming all at once. So suddenly there's thousands of people. There's huge processions. There's big neoclassical buildings.
It looks like a good time.
It's all going off.
Doesn't it?
Great.
Yeah. That's Eddie's entry point into this, is let's all go up there for our holidays.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. There's going to be some wine. Everyone's having a good time. Everyone's dressed well.
Yeah.
Eddie turns up. And then painting number four, Destruction.
You're not putting him off.
In which these crowds, this tumultuous crowd of people, now start turning on each other. There's war. There's burning buildings. You know, the statues have all been decapitated. It's pretty serious. And it's an amazing painting because if you look up close, it's all going off now. And then the final painting is called Desolation. So we're then back in the same landscape, but now everything's ruined. Everything's kind of been knocked over and nature's coming back. There's no people. That's it. It's all over. But, you know, it's returning back to its original. So it's a cycle. But in the middle of that, there's this kind of destruction.
Thanks for talking us through Thomas Cole. It's amazing stuff. How does the National Gallery, how do these two shows work in tandem, Eddie? Our listeners will probably know Ed Rocher's work. Clean, lean, poppy, modern. He's the sort of arch chronicler of the landscape of the highway and architecture at his best, viewed at 50 miles an hour in an American automobile. How do these two shows square off at each other in the National Gallery?
So it starts off upstairs with a series of five black and white paintings, which Ed Rocher did in the early 90s, and they each show different ugly bits of LA. So there's a tech chem plant, there's a tool shop, there's a phone box, there's a tire shop. And so those are hung quite high up. And then underneath them is a new series, or a more recent series, which he did for the Venice Biennale, of the exact same views, repeated but now in colour, and showing what those buildings have become. So the tech chem plant has become a FAP, something called a FAP, which I'm assuming it's a restaurant. The phone box has been replaced by a bird and a sort of phone pole. So everything's changed. And so the way that relates back to...
So there's something about the demise, or the change of use, or the demise of some sort of empire of use.
Yeah, and one of the other things is that a black and white trade school now becomes a cordoned off. It looks like a prison. It's probably not a prison. It's just something empty looking. So yeah, for him, the black and white ones are about blue collar LA and what they've become. What those bits of Los Angeles that once housed these poor working class Americans, what these buildings have turned into. So one of them has become a Korean supermarket, for example. And so he's painted that in the garish colours of Korean supermarkets. So that obviously relates directly back to Thomas Cole, because Thomas Cole was saying, look at how America's changing. And it seems like Rocher's going, look at how America's changed. But I think there's a really massive difference in how they approach it, because Thomas Cole is full of warnings and going, please don't let America go. Don't let this happen. I beg you, look what will happen if you continue on this path. We'll end up destroying everything and there'll be wine. Don't let wine happen. Wine and parties, no. anything but good times. Honestly, he sounds like a very boring man, old Thomas Cole.
Poor old Thomas.
But I don't think that's what Rocher's doing. I don't think there's...
Is there a sense of morality, do you think, in this? Is this the times they're changing and it's a bad thing? Or
I don't think that comes across. Yeah. And I think that's a good thing. But one of the main reasons is like an artistic reason, which is that it goes from monochrome to colour, as if life has seeped back into these spaces as they've changed. And I really think it's a fundamental difference between the two of them, which is Thomas Cole saying, stuff's changing and that's not good and we need to stop it. And Rocher's going, stuff's changing. Full stop. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really interesting difference between them, because course of empire on the other hand, and then course of just stuff happening, man. Relax, I think.
But there's also the apocalyptic skies, there's the red sky, there's the kind of
there's the fence.
Acid rain, there's the fence.
Yeah.
There is foreboding here, and I agree, he's probably not quite as buttoned up as Cole was, or as moralising. You know, he's just like, you've got to let this go. It's going to happen. Entropy. We can't do anything about this.
And I suppose this is the natural state of empire. You squeeze the soap too tight and it pops out of your hands anyway.
Yeah.
How does Ed Rocher make either or both of you feel? Because I love his work and I feel there is something clean and clinical about it, but also something of an emotional response. And by the way, with these paintings that you're referring to, Eddie, in this show at the National Gallery, these aren't the kind of what we might call the beautiful things, like the Los Angeles County Museum on fire, or one of the kind of classic American gas stations from the 1950s, which I think we can all acknowledge now are beautiful things and works of great architecture. These are kind of squat, cinder block, kind of pretty ordinary buildings, aren't they? Do you see beauty in this? How does Ed Rocher make you feel?
I find it really tough with him, because he doesn't make me feel a huge amount, but I really like that. I feel like he coming at the tail end of pop. Pop's not necessarily about all that much emotion. It's about reducing things down to a much simpler, snappier form of visual aesthetic. And so when I look at his stuff, which I love, I'm just glad that it's there. And I'm like, I keep every time I see his work, I think, why didn't I think of that? Why am I not as cool as Ed Ruscha? Because he's so calm, so considered, so laid back in the way he approaches the things he paints. So I don't actually feel a huge amount when I look at those. I think they're a visual.
There's
symbols.
A certain idea of them that's a bit like a logo almost.
Yeah, there is exactly. Something, very consumable. Your eyes want to sort of drink it all in. Yeah. And that's what I get from. I get this sort of sense I need to be around. I want to drink it in. Whereas when I look at Thomas Cole, I get the sense that things are about to go to pot.
Well, I think when I look at Ed Ruscha, I think that he brings all of that art history in as well. You know, because you do look at it and you go, oh, that's just LA, you know, on fire or whatever, and you kind of do take it at face value. But then he's always referring back. So whether it's Thomas Cole or Duchamp, he's always working in series, processes and systems. So that's kind of why you're like, oh, that's such a genius idea, just taking pictures of all the gasoline or all the parking lots on this Sunset Strip or whatever. You know, they're all based on a kind of closed system. And I suppose that's what makes him so attractive to younger artists as well. So I was just in Japan where I was looking at this book and I was like, oh, this is Ed Ruscha's book. It's like, oh, no, that's my version of an Ed Ruscha where he goes down the freeway and throws a TV out of the window and then documents it. And so this young Japanese guy chucked a MacBook out of the window of his car, like his electric car in Tokyo, but made exactly the same book, you know, a facsimile. Yeah. And it's just that repetition of something quite sort of basic. You know, the Thomas Cole thing is the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. You know, it's the obvious kind of link. It's just we all know the story and it's a moral fable. Yes, it's going to come back around. And, you know, is it all negative, or do you at the end think, wow, yeah, I can't wait until this civilization just crumbles and we all go back to being hunter-gatherers. And so there is kind of hope, I suppose.
I think there's a lot of positivity in Thomas Cole because he's so clearly overwhelmingly in love with the American landscape.
Yeah.
Because what he doesn't have, what he didn't nick from Turner is a sort of washed out abstraction out of focus. Everything he does is incredibly clean, crisp,
it's right
precise.
There, isn't it? Yeah.
Everything is so in focus, and it's, I mean, I don't massively like it, but what he wants to do is document this beautiful country. You know, it's sort of like what you got with the Australian Impressionists as well, which is this, like, we need to document this. Yeah. It's so perfect, so beautiful. I need to do it perfectly. And that's, you know, I find it a bit boring.
Is this what happens though? Is this in the 1850s when Cole's work was being painted, and then we go to, you know, the 1950s to the 80s to the 90s, and now with this, we're making light of the fact that the landscape's kind of been trashed. It's the man-made things that we kind of almost ironically like these kind of crappy buildings. Mm. We maybe feel a sort of cultural ownership over the name that was on the side of that. It would have had a good old kind of white Christian blue collar name on it, and now it's got something you can't even read because it's in the Korean alphabet, for example, or whatever it is. Do we think there's a sense of sort of maybe we've lost the landscape, but Ruscha is saying we've also lost these surnames that we used to have. We've lost even the logos on the side of the buildings. This is how empires change.
Yeah, I don't think he's sort of down on the
No, I'm not saying he's down on it. Yeah. I just wonder whether that's a bit of the implication. It's difficult to know with Ruscha, though.
I did think that, and I did immediately go, oh God, I hope he's not upset that there's a Korean supermarket.
No, I
don't
want
that to be there. Yeah.
And also there's graffiti on the side of that building. That's one of my favourite pairings, those two paintings. Because also the original one is called Tool and Die, which is obviously like a kind of tool and die stamping manufacturing.
Yeah, kind of die cast.
Yeah, but it's also pretty foreboding, you know, Tool and Die.
Tool and Die.
And then you go to the Korean thing and it's actually more interesting visually, and the graffiti's kind of upbeat. It's not like, oh, the world's gone to pot, you know, it's not all bad. But I think what he can do is remain sort of aloof. That's Ed Ruscha language, you know, it's just like aloof. You're not quite sure where he sits on the fence, you know, at any point. You're not quite sure whether to take these as like real foreboding tales. Whereas with Thomas Cole, you know, because in his famous last painting, which is called The Oxbow, which really is a glorious thing of all Eddie was talking about, this kind of just looking at the landscape, he's right at the front with his little hat looking out as if to say, you know, don't you mess this up. He's like looking at us. It's like a little challenge. Even though it's a tiny little guy, he's like, look, I'm sat in the middle of this wilderness and this is what, you know, what I'm going to give to you, but don't you go around screwing it all up.
I think Ed Richet is far from a man that's afraid of the future, because he's a big car guy. As we said, he's the kind of man that's documented the life of the American highway and the architecture directly off of it. And when I mentioned to him a couple of years ago at his studio in Culver City, he's got a great car collection. His most treasured one is a 1920s Ford van, like the kind of one that, I don't know if you had collected the Kellogg's Matchbox cars, that one. Yeah. But he drives to work in a Tesla these days, I think.
Okay,
so I think he gets it.
He gets Thomas Cole's warning. Okay, so he's not still driving his six-cylinder beast.
I think with that small snippet of biographical information, we've solved the riddle, lads.
Excellent.
Anyway, so it's beautiful stuff. Now, this is our further reading section, Ossian.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to stay in the United States. We're going to move to kind of landscape artists that have depicted and used the American landscape. Tell us how Cole and Ed Richet led to this thing that you want to alert our listeners to.
Yeah, it was purely because I was reading this rather cool magazine. It's called Even. It's an art magazine. It's new, 10 issues. So that's like 3 years old, I guess, edited by someone that Eddie knows, Jason Farrago.
Yeah, someone I went to university with.
Yeah, good writer. And this particular issue is great. It goes from, are we killing our Tibetan paintings by badly restoring them, to what are phones doing to our museum going, which is a really good piece. Jason Moran, really interesting artist, pianist. And the piece that I picked up on is called Natural Causes by Annie Godfrey Larmon. And it's about going to see some of these things, like going to the lightning field, going to see
So these are big land art. Canon of land art. Yeah.
So Michael Heitzer, you know, Robert Smithson, all these guys, you know. And what they did, so Walter Di Maria made the lightning field, these 100 poles stuck in the desert. You go there, you have to drive for hours, you get there, you wait and see if there's any lightning. Inevitably there isn't. You stay the night on this little hut in the middle of nowhere, and then you kind of have a weird, disappointing...
Have you been in...
Yeah, I've done a few of them. I've done the lightning field, I did some of Marfa. I haven't done, as actually she admits, she didn't go to Spiral Jetty. Spiral Jetty's kind of the Robert Smithson one, where he created this rock formation that looks like a spiral in the middle of this salt lake. But what she gets onto is how long it takes to get there. It's a ball ache to get there. It's hard work when you're there.
Isn't the point that it's about a pilgrimage? It's about a sense of opening up your psyche to the wonder of the Wild West and stuff.
Yeah.
And then, or as Austin calls it, a ball ache. They don't put that in the press release, do they?
I thought you were going to edit that out. Sorry, just keep repeating it now. But the idea is that you're kind of doing the gas guzzling thing, going there, spending effort and energy. And yes, it's part of the journey. But, you know, this spiral jetty, when Smithson made it, it was very quickly subsumed by the water, by the level of the lake. And now the drought and the weather is such that you can see it again, and it's covered in these salt crystals and looks beautiful. But it's kind of also telling you something's going wrong with the landscape. Yeah. And the same with the De Maria, the lightning field, the ground is all parched. It's kind of falling apart. And another famous work, which is called, I think it's called Double Negative, which is just a big slice out of the ground, like a big chasm. It's falling in on itself. It's falling apart. It's not the clean lines that it was. It's not a kind of industrial cut anymore. So they're discussing whether to keep this work of land art and conserve it and make it right again. Or is it all just going to fall apart? Is it supposed to become one with the landscape?
What do we think about this? I kind of wonder whether there is, obviously, if it were a painting and it were worth a lot of money, and if it were hanging in a gallery, we would get the art restorers on it. But if it's meant to be about the landscape, maybe the change of landscape is the most profound thing it can possibly say. I don't know.
I can't believe that Robert Smithson didn't think this would happen. I'm sure when he built Spiral Jetty, which is so stunning, which I'd love to go and see, he knew that it's land art. The land degrades, land changes. I don't think for a second that he was arrogant enough to think that his stamp on the land should last for eternity. I think he wanted it to degrade. He wanted it to fall apart and to fall into disrepair. All land art is part of the land. It should fall apart. I mean, I think it tells you a lot about climate change and all that, but I think these things are designed and deserve to fall apart. And I think it would be sad if someone came along and started messing with Spiral Jetty. I'd be very upset.
Yeah, I think that is the irony, because Deer Foundation are beholden to conserve it to some degree. Mm. But Smithson was all about entropy. He was like, that was what his work was about. So I think some of these other guys were talking about, oh, this work is going to last forever, or, you know, and now they're discussing what that is and what is the point in a way. She talks about, you know, people turning up in a helicopter or, you know, to come and see this work and then disappearing off again. It's kind of the art world tourism gone wrong. And she's part of that and she understands it. And then the backdrop of all of this is, you know, Trump pulling out of the Paris Agreement and, you know, record levels of climate change. And so it's a kind of open-ended piece at the end. She doesn't really give you the answer, like, we should do this. But it's that we should look at them through this new lens, as if to say it's not like it was before. It's not this kind of grand statement. It's sort of crumbling. It's doing the Thomas Cole thing. It's becoming part of the landscape again, and we should look at it anew and maybe criticize it for its kind of slightly overpowering awe factor, you know, and think, well, shouldn't it just return to dust?
And, well, so it's an explicit link you're making between the Thomas Cole, nothing ever stays the same, empires rise and fall, and this kind of idea of the kind of the golden age of land art was probably, what, the 50s and 60s, when these places were still in the middle of nowhere, where there was a kind of, you definitely had this sense of pilgrimage of getting there by hook and by crook, and then kind of having to give yourself up to the land and the landscape and the weather and stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, we do it all the time in the art world. We travel too much. And, you know, I've been to some of these places and had these huge journeys to get there in multiple airplanes. And you sort of don't think about it. And I suppose what she's saying is that that's really what's behind some of this, that maybe we should be re-engaging with the landscape, but as it is now. And, you know, maybe not thinking about these things as heroic, about thinking them as kind of failing objects.
And just generally, to satisfy my curiosity, possibly that, if we're lucky, of our listeners as well, what the original, the land artists, were they proto kind of conservationists?
Yeah.
Were some of them, I tend to think they must have been, right?
Yeah, super ecological people.
Yeah. It was that was the high point of the sort of environmentalism of the 70s. They were all, you know, they were getting back to the land. Ecological precarity was the watchword of the day, and they were all thinking about this. But it's like, then it becomes this great big tourist site, and then it becomes a monument, you know?
A monument, exactly.
And then it changes its meaning somehow. And I think maybe at some point we lost that original impetus, and that now we need to kind of reconnect with that. So I think that's sort of what it's about.
I also think that the design of being designed to degrade is so important. It's also someone like Richard Long, you know, his walks, when he leaves those marks, they're meant to disappear. Mm. And I think that's a really important and essential part of the art, and the idea of conserving them destroys the intention of the art.
Yeah,
yeah. I think that's maybe why, you know, because I work with Richard Long and he doesn't like the term land art. Maybe that's the problem he has with land art, that it's creating a monument. Whereas, as you said, he walks in the Amazon, makes a circle of palm leaves, takes a picture, and then leaves it, and then, you know, they'll degrade and rot, and that will just become part of nature again, and his intervention was fleeting. And I think he maybe has a problem with these things. They're still there 50 years later.
Oh, I love Richard Long. Well, best eyebrows in the art world.
Let's get him on.
Let's get him on. Eddie, your further reading on the topic of Cole and Richet are the novels of J.G. Ballard, especially the ones set in London. I can kind of see a link, but talk us through this one.
It was quite hard, especially because I obviously had far more positive feelings for Ed Richet than Thomas Cole. The thing that actually Thomas Cole made me think of more than J.G. Ballard was the industrial paintings of the Impressionists. So Monet's paintings of the Gare Saint-Lazare and stuff like that, where it's these very smoky, polluted environments. And I think the reason I like them so much is because there's no judgment there either. This is also just the documenting of what's happened to a space. So I think that's probably why my heart goes a bit more towards France than these bloody Americans.
Why didn't you have, what's his name? Michel Houellebecq.
Oh, yeah.
You can have Michel Houellebecq. If you're feeling like you need a contemporary Ballard figure, but you want to sit him in France, maybe you can have
him. Well, so I think the thing about Ballard that's really interesting in relation to Richet and Cole, especially in terms of, it's specifically his London novels. Mm. So The Drowned World, Concrete Island, High Rise, Crash. These are novels about concrete, brutal places that are changing, and that as they change, morality changes with them. So if you think about The Drowned World, which describes a London where the seas have risen, and so it's all these people living on the roof of the Ritz, and they're returning to their brutal savage sides and how morality degrades along with the buildings, and so everything's falling apart, and as the physical structures around these people fall apart, they fall apart inside themselves as well. And it's such an incredible book.
Such a good book. Any of his London books I'll take. I'd take on any desert island, any concrete island.
Actually, Concrete Island I find a lot harder to read, because I think it makes me feel so paranoid and claustrophobic, and because it's about someone crashing off the Westway and being stuck between two bits of the motorway and not being able to escape, and I can just imagine it happening to me in a bloody Uber. And I'm just stuck with just me and the Uber driver going, well, looks like we're here for eternity, mate.
Yeah.
Let's hope someone chucks over a can of Coke.
Yeah, just until everyone's iPhone runs out of battery.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's it. So basically dead after effectively
four and a half hours. No battery life.
I know, it's terrible, isn't it?
But then you go to the harsher, more Ballardian novels, where you end up with high rise in this massive building where everyone is slowly turning on each other because we're not meant to be living in these concrete spaces. And same with Concrete Island, we're not meant to be surrounded by that much concrete. It's making us fall apart mentally. And the big thing with Ballard is that he saw morality as a curtain that at any second could drop. And so we can all act entirely nicely to each other, but within a flash, we can suddenly turn and we will allow our basest instincts. And so looking at the work of Ed Ruscha, you see these concrete spaces that are just sort of barely holding on to what they were designed for, and they're barely holding on to what they've become, and you can see things falling apart. And I don't think Ballard is necessarily all that judgmental when he talks about them, because so many of the characters...
Well, I always think Ballard's protagonists always, when there's a fight going on or there's some sort of awful moment, they walk into the fire. They never walk away from it. They consider walking away from it and walk straight into it just because they're curious about knowing what they'll do in that situation.
Yeah.
And I feel maybe that's Ed Ruscha, but maybe not Thomas Cole, who's warning us against that kind of
totally
running towards the flames.
And also so many of the characters in those novels are called James, and they're doctors, and they live in West London, and they're clearly him. Crash was based on him having a girlfriend who was into some weird sex stuff, amongst many other things. And it's him trying to navigate having these incredibly difficult urges and being with someone with urges that are unconventional, and how we deal with that within a city, and how the city affects us, and how we think about cars and technology, and how technology could be sexy, and how crashes can be sexy, and how that's a really conflicting emotion. And that really relates back to Ruscha, which is not a, you idiots, I can't believe you're doing this. It's a, whoa, we're doing this. I guess we're having sex with people who've had a car crash, I guess. I guess that's a thing we're doing now.
Yeah.
You know, it's just this big, huh.
But
okay.
Ruscha is never quite so dystopian, is he? He's never quite so, like, you know, it's all going to pot. He's more like, let's just keep cruising along the highway. Okay, we've got to switch to a Tesla now. But it's still the kind of the American dream is there in the background. He never quite stamps on it in the way that Cole does. You know, he never quite says, stop.
I guess Ruscha plays his cards close to his chest like the other people that we've talked about kind of haven't. They've kind of they've planted a flag in whichever territory they've kind of wanted to. It's fascinating stuff. I can't believe we've gone from the Hudson Valley to the highways and byways of Los Angeles. We ended up in Shepparton via...
Bolton.
But via... Oh, you know, via the kind of wilds of the Wild West and some beautiful land art. That brings us to the end of today's programme. You can see both exhibitions of Ed Ruscha and Thomas Cole at the National Gallery until the 7th of October. Thank you very much indeed to my two guests today, Eddie Frankel and Ossian Ward, and my producer, of course, Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time next week, but for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.